There was nothing sexual there. In the several years that I had known these artists, they had never seen me with a man, so it was a novel process. There was an immediate bond between RZA and Yan Ming. I believe they knew each other in past lifetimes. RZA started training right away. He would send a limo to pick up Yan Ming and bring him to the Wu Mansion in South Jersey. I didn't always accompany him. There were times when RZA made it clear that he wanted to spend time alone with Yan Ming. He would say something like,
"Look, Soph, this time it's just for the men."
And I appreciated his candor. On one occasion when I did go, I watched as RZA asked about every kung fu style he'd ever been curious about. Yan Ming would explain the style and the philosophy behind it, then demonstrate it. It was incredible to watch RZA's curiosity satisfied instantaneously by this living, breathing, practicing Kung Fu-pedia. Naturally, I introduced Yan Ming to all my friends and family as well. My parents loved him. He was more culturally aligned with them than I was, because he was basically an old-school Asian. He taught my parents stretches, and my mother loved cooking for him. He was a prodigious eater. Everyone loved Yan Ming, us as a couple, and who I was becoming with him. I was more patient and more present. Chris approved, probably relieved that I didn't end up with someone in the industry whom he'd have to violate if I got hurt. The Austins welcomed him into their home and family immediately. We were fortunate enough to spend time with all three generations of Austins. Michael's mother, Evelyn, God rest her soul, was uniquely wonderful. She was the matriarch of the family, and I see her influence in her three granddaughters, Anika, Layla, and Annabelle, who are all smart and funny, but most importantly, kind and generous and empathetic. Mo took Yan Ming, Michael, Lenny, and me to lunch at Morton's, a high-end steakhouse in Beverly Hills. We were ushered in like royalty and seated at a center booth where everyone could see us. Yan Ming's eyes widened as a stream of people approached the table to say hello, lawyer Johnny Cochran among them. When we left, Mo pulled me aside and said with a sly smile, "You know, Sophia, that place is full of movers and shakers." What I remember distinctly about that lunch and every other occasion that I was fortunate enough to spend time with him is that Mo never once looked at his watch. I never felt like I was taking up his time. And I can't say that for far lesser executives. I took note and wanted to be sure that I would always try to make people feel valued, as he did. Yan Ming loved the Austins, naturally. They were loving and super healthy and respectful of their bodies. You know, Cali living. Under Yan Ming's tutelage, my body was turning into a strong, lean, flexible machine, but it was my mind, soul, and spirit that were truly transformed. In Shaolin, we train every part of our being simultaneously. Yan Ming would say, "Stretch your body, stretch your mind." There's a brilliant movie called Shaolin Soccer, directed by and starring Stephen Chow, about a man who pulls together former kung fu masters to form a team. The movie ends with a montage of people incorporating kung fu into their quotidian routines, like walking down the street, parking a car, waiting for a bus. It's a fun visual, but the meaning is much deeper. The idea is that we can incorporate kung fu into everything we do. I use my kung fu every day, in everything I do, both physical and mental. RZA and GZA would say the same about how they incorporate chess into every aspect of their lives. I learned the greatest spiritual lessons of my life from Yan Ming. One of the most extraordinary things about him was that he never complained, ever. He was always glass half full. Before I met him, I was the kind of person who would insist on taking the train because we couldn't find a cab, and then when the train was taking too long, kvetch that we should have waited for a cab. I would complain about the rain, and he would say, "Sophia, the trees and the plants and the flowers need the rain." If someone at a restaurant or an airport counter was being a dick, he would kill them with kindness and positivity. He was extraordinary this way. I hardly have his spiritual constitution, but I strive to be mindful of my behavior and energy and how they impact those around me. There was one person, however, who didn't embrace our relationship. My partner, Denise. For some inexplicable reason, she hated it when I called him my boyfriend. Why can't you just call him by his name? Because I like calling him my boyfriend, Denise. I'm really happy to have a boyfriend, and it's been a really long time. I was taken aback by her anger. I understand now that she wasn't in a good place herself and projecting onto me. She became furious when she found out that I confided in our attorney that Yanming was married, which I had only done to get a referral for a divorce lawyer. Clearly, there was something about my relationship with Yanming that bothered her. It couldn't be Yanming himself. She'd barely spent any time with him, and he was utterly likable. Denise disbanded the company soon thereafter, which came as a total shock. She told me that she had spent her whole life standing in the shadows of brilliant men and felt like she was doing the same with me. Whoa, what? I told her I wouldn't have had the confidence to start the company without her, that I needed her marketing expertise. I saw us as completely equal partners. Little did I know that decades later, I would have the same revelation about feeling unseen. I'm grateful that she was forthcoming enough to tell me how it felt to work closely with me. The company folding was a disappointment, but I was still managing Dirty, which was a wild ride and a great learning experience. I stayed with him through the release of his debut album, Return to the 36 Chambers, but not long thereafter. The combination of how difficult managing him was and how much more involved I was getting in the temple drew that phase of my career to its inevitable close. Beyond training, it was clear that I could help Yanming by managing him and the temple. My first management client was ODB, and my second Yanming. Talk about Wu-Tang and Shaolin. In 1996, RZA closed the deal that he'd been talking to Denise and me about, but with a different label. He hired me as the general manager of Razor Sharp Records.
So, yo, look, I've chosen you to run my label.
Having been a GM of two small labels since then, I can see now how I was again not qualified to run the business, but I appreciate that RZA put his trust in me. I worked my ass off and did a fine job, but I was limited by my inexperience. I hadn't managed a team and knew little of finance. While there, I oversaw the release of Ghostface Killah's phenomenal debut solo album, Iron Man. The photo shoot for the album cover, with all the two-tone Clarks Wallaby shoes, was one of my favorite sets ever. Ultimately, RZA and I parted ways because we didn't see eye to eye on how to manage the staff, but we remained friends. I believed so deeply in Yanming's vision that I left music behind and fell into managing him and the temple full-time. In retrospect, I see that I was walking away from a very promising career, managing one of the hottest rappers on the scene who was part of a hip-hop supergroup that surely would have led to more opportunities, money, and power, but that didn't even occur to me then. By immersing myself so wholly in Shaolin, I was also distancing myself away from my music community. Naturally, RZA remained in our lives because of his bond with Yanming, but we saw the other members of Wu-Tang less often. The same can be said of Chris. I didn't expect the guys in the clan to call me to hang out. That's not how we engaged. But I was disappointed that I didn't hear from or see Chris much during that time. I didn't reach out to him enough either, but I was very aware of his movements because he was becoming a major force in the industry. Regardless, when I did see the clan or Chris, it was like visiting my hometown and seeing my high school buddies. Like no time had elapsed, and our love picked up right where it had left off. I knew that the temple and Yanming were my future. It was a big endeavor because I was building something from the ground up with a largely unknown figurehead. I knew that getting the word out about him was key to our success. A big part of the strategy was his association with RZA. It was such a great story, and Wu-Tang was at the height of their popularity at the time. RZA was incredibly gracious and never said no to anything to do with the temple. In September 1999, I pulled off a remarkable, if somewhat underhanded, PR coup. I got Yanming on the covers of the four top Kung Fu magazines in the world, Inside Kung Fu, Kung Fu, and two magazines in China. I managed to do it without any of them knowing about the others. It meant that as a martial arts fan, when you went to your local bookstore, martial arts supply store, or magazine shop for the latest issue, you saw Yan Ming on every single cover. Once those covers ran, the Discovery Channel called and asked Yan Ming to participate in a martial arts documentary called Secrets of the Warrior's Power. Yan Ming was prominently featured in the program, and his picture was on the packaging. After the show aired, our phone rang off the hook, and our membership ballooned quickly. And as is the case with all press, more soon followed. National Geographic, CNBC, TNT, and more. It felt glorious to be part of this burgeoning movement. I love managing artists because I believe that their art has transformative power. But the impact of this work was much more direct and immediate. I watched as people's bodies, minds, and spirits evolved before my eyes. And I was doing the same. I flung myself out of my comfort zone and rushed to meet every challenge. But I was about to be faced with the biggest hurdle of my life. Not long after the 4th of July weekend in 1999, I was lying on the couch while Yan Ming cooked his daily meal of a giant bowl of noodle soup. He loved Chinese brown vinegar, which has a very strong smell. I'd gotten used to it, but on this particular day, it turned my stomach. I knew it immediately. Holy shit, I'm pregnant. Less than a year before, Joan had told me she was pregnant and that her sense of smell went through the roof. I went quickly to the Duane Reade on the corner and bought a first response pregnancy kit. I had never used one before. I went in the bathroom, peed on the stick, and waited for the pink lines to appear. If it's one line, you're not pregnant. If two, you are. Takes about 3 minutes. The first line always appears. It's waiting for the second that pushes you to the edge of the toilet seat. We weren't trying to get pregnant, but we weren't trying to avoid it either. When that second pink line appeared, ever so slowly but surely, a big-ass smile spread across my lips. I went into the living room and showed Yan Ming. Our love was going to climb to another level. The very next day, I made an appointment to see Dr. Allen, my OBGYN. I peed in a cup, they drew my blood, and it all came back positive. When I got home, I called Joan and asked her to meet me. We had lunch on DeKalb, close to her place in Brooklyn, and I brought out a small, flimsy, blurred black and white image. She took the sonogram from me and started crying immediately. Our pregnancies would overlap by a month. During pregnancy, I didn't glow as much as I glowered. Throughout my first trimester, I was exhausted. Even lifting the remote seemed like a Herculean task. For someone as energetic and active as me, I hated being slowed down. As much as I just wanted to lie on the couch and watch TV, I had already committed to the biggest undertaking of my life that demanded my full attention. In less than 6 weeks, we were going to lead a group of 50 students, disciples, and friends on a tour of Shaolin Temple and other sites in China. I had found the travel agent, dealt with all the visas, created the itinerary, and hired a documentary crew. It was everyone's first time to Shaolin Temple, and for many, including myself, the first time to China. We were a diverse crew that ranged in age from teenagers to middle-aged across the racial spectrum. The tie that bound us was a love for Shaolin Kung Fu and a reverence for Yan Ming. On the day of the flight, everyone met at the temple. The room was buzzing with anticipation, piled high with luggage. The excitement was barely contained by the time we boarded the plane. The one person who would meet us at the airport was Riza. While everyone else was taking pictures of themselves on the plane before takeoff, I was trying to reach Riza because he hadn't boarded yet. When I finally contacted him, he was at the airport but had gone to the wrong terminal. He missed the flight by minutes. Even after we landed in Hong Kong and the entourage was jumping for joy, I couldn't relax until I knew Riza was on the next flight. Finally, he made it to the gate back in New York and I exhaled. With the itinerary tightly organized, I anticipated no other bumps. But I would soon learn that the best laid plans of mice and sow off go awry. Shaolin was the first place I had ever visited that felt like a third world country. There were people sleeping outside on mattresses, toddlers shitting in the streets in broad daylight, and stand after stand of noodles, trinkets, and souvenirs run by people who looked bone-weary. It was the 1500th anniversary of the temple, and huge celebrations were planned. Every morning before dawn, we were awakened by the synchronized footsteps of boys aged as young as 5 up to their early 20s chanting E-R, E-R, or 1-2-1-2. After all the movies we had seen and the lessons learned, visiting the actual sites was profoundly moving. It was like the first time I had gone to Paris and laid eyes on the landmarks that I'd read about in college, but with an added spiritual component. My soul was tied to this hallowed ground. The huge red doors, the pagoda garden of masters past, the elevated plum blossom stakes on which the monks trained, the cave on Mount Sung where Bodhidharma had sat and meditated for 9 years. Yanming's master, Shu Rongqian, was quiet and reserved, but clearly powerful. Meeting him was like meeting Yanming's father. Then there was his kung fu brother and closest friend, Shi Deyang, a 32nd generation Shaolin monk, one of the top ranked at the temple. From the moment we arrived at the Dongfeng Airport, we were greeted and escorted by Deyang and his disciples. On the second day of our visit, Riza performed for the monks, the first artist to ever do so at the Shaolin Temple. Deyang's disciples formed a human chain around Riza. They stood guard and watched him bob and weave and sway as he rhymed in words they couldn't understand, but with an energy that they absorbed. I was proud to create this piece of history where martial arts and hip-hop intersected, Shaolin and Wu-Tang, old and new. At the end of one particularly wonderful day full of training, sightseeing, and the best Chinese food I'd ever had, Yanming, Deyang, and I were walking through the main training center near the temple when we came upon a woman holding 2 children, around 5 and 7, by the hand. She looked angry, resolved, and nervous all at once. Yanming and Deyang stopped in their tracks. They definitely recognized her, and she was definitely waiting for us. It took a moment, but I realized that she was Yanming's wife, and those were his 2 children. Deyang gently took me by the hand and led me away. I didn't hear any words, and I didn't look back. Clearly, this was something he'd have to handle on his own. My mind was filled with questions. How had she found Yanming? Why did she feel compelled to stalk and ambush him? Something wasn't right about this picture. I knew very little about how much Yanming communicated with her while we were in New York, but clearly not enough if she went to such measures to speak with him. As a mother, I now feel badly for the kids. What must they have been thinking? It was a couple of days before we were scheduled to leave Shaolin Village, but Yanming decided that we all needed to leave immediately because he understood that someone pretty high up at the temple and or the government must have conspired with his wife to find us. Staying would only become more complicated and potentially dangerous, particularly because he wasn't yet a U.S. citizen. That night, we gathered everyone up in the dark. Suddenly mobilizing a group of 50 people is not easy. Deyang escorted us to the edge of Shaolin Village, and I hugged him tightly. Next stop, Wu-Tang Mountain. We had all seen Jet Li's classic kung fu flick, Tai Chi Master, multiple times and were well-versed in the legend of Zhan Song Feng, a Taoist master who founded the martial art Tai Chi in the Wu-Tang Mountains. The anticipation was palpable. We took a 2-hour ride from Shaolin Temple to the Zhengzhou train station. From there, it was an 8-hour ride to Wuhan in Hubei province, where Wu-Tang is located. The train was an anachronism, like something out of an old Western. Yanming and I had a private cabin with a double bed. Once he'd put our bags up, I ate a protein bar, which Dr. Allen had scared me into thinking was the only thing I should eat on the trip to China. Then the rocking train put me to sleep. I slept 4 hours. When I awoke, I was very groggy and made my way to the bathroom car. When I opened the door to the stall, I was shocked to see not a toilet, but an opening in the floor. Well, one in China. As I squatted over the gap and watched the tracks roll past below me, I wondered whose literally shitty job it was to clean up after me. I got up and stopped by the food car where Riza was drinking with a bunch of students. I returned to my car and went back to sleep. When we finally arrived at the station, we loaded ourselves into two small buses and made our way to the hotel. I was relieved to be off the train and put my feet on terra firma. I felt like I was still rocking. The trip up the winding mountain road was terrifying. The driver swerved into the oncoming traffic to switch lanes. I'd never seen that shit before. Luckily, one of our Chinese-American students introduced me to Bai Huayo, Chinese white flower oil. This miraculous combination of wintergreen, peppermint, menthol, eucalyptus, camphor, and lavender immediately abated my nausea. It has the added properties of being a decongestant and mosquito repellent. When we finally arrived at the hotel, I sprang off the bus ahead of everyone else. I shook off the journey and took in the breathtaking scene. High on the mountaintop, we could see mountains for miles in every direction. More spellbinding still was observing Riza. One of 10 children raised by a single mother in the projects of Staten Island, he was the boy who had memorized the miraculous moves, archetypal characters, and poorly dubbed dialogue of the kung fu flicks that had provided him with an escape into another world. That boy grew up to be the man who founded the greatest rap group of all time and named it after the famed mountain range. And here we were now, standing at its mile-high peak. Riza slowly rotated a full 360 degrees to take it all in. When he was facing me again, he said,
"Yo, so, take a picture. Yo, look at that mountain behind us."
"What about it?"
"Yo, it's the W, like the Wu logo."
And goddamn if he wasn't right. Behind him, the mountains were shaped like a W, like the Wu-Tang logo. Not only did the Riza have an ear, he also had an eye. He wore his white, raw cotton Shaolin temple vest with yellow trim. He looked regal and proud, and like he had arrived. The next day, we visited the Temple of the Purple Cloud, which had been constructed in the 12th century. As we approached, I knew immediately that it was going to be different from Shaolin. Wu-Tang was pristine. No souvenir shops, no roadside vendors, just a magnificent temple. Everything felt ancient, centuries old. Even the master of the temple, with his beautiful, long, thick black hair tied in a bun atop his head and his traditional white silk suit that moved gently with him as he descended the stairs, looked like he'd stepped out of a time machine. And yes, he was fine. The only thing that betrayed that we were, in fact, in the 20th century was the cordless phone he held to his head. As he reached us at the entrance, he clasped his right hand around his left fist, a greeting of respect, just like they do in kung fu flicks, and welcomed us with a huge smile. Watching him and Mai Yanming approach each other was historic. As a fan of the genre, I knew that Shaolin and Wu-Tang were always pitted against each other. And again, there was Riza. The first order of the day was for the schools to perform for each other as a sign of respect. There's something important and honorable about being chosen to perform for another master. You are not representing yourself, but your master and his tradition. Demonstrating in perfect synchronization as a team takes a lot of practice and chemistry that is established by the master. When done right, it's like a single beating heart. Like their leader, the Wu-Tang crew wore off-white silk robes with their long hair tied into a knot at the top of their heads. They performed with and without weapons, and yes, they exhibited a Wu-Tang sword style. Our team kicked and stomped and yelled like warriors in our bright saffron robes. The students on both sides performed with dignity and pride. But they were just the undercard. Here came the main event. The masters would now present their skills. Our host went first. He walked slowly and deliberately to the center of the stone square and proceeded to perform Tai Chi. His flow was slow and mesmerizing, like water. Most people think of elderly Chinese people in the parks doing Tai Chi, which is good and real, but it doesn't quite paint a full picture of the art form. It is a martial art. Done well, it's beautiful and awesome, and you have no doubt that the practitioner is a fighter. Our team all wondered what our Shifu would perform. I had seen his whole repertoire and knew that his Tai Chi was superlative. But certainly, he wouldn't do Tai Chi in the house that built Tai Chi, would he? Yeming clapped heartily, then strode into the center of the crowd, bald head high and back erect, winning smile on his face. His smile quickly disappeared as he focused and summoned his chi. He had told me that you can tell a martial artist by their eyes. If they don't look like Mike Tyson stepping into a ring, they're not legit. We watched breathlessly as he raised his shoulders and hands as if he were pulling the energy out of the ground he stood on. Oh shit, he's gonna do Tai Chi. My man is a competitive motherfucker. He transitioned into a fighting form that showed his awesome power. He is a fighter to the core, and it takes only one swift sidekick to demonstrate beyond the shadow of a doubt that he is a stone-cold killer. He was the national fighting champion of China, not a small country, 2 years running. Throughout the demonstration, Riza stood quiet and erect, taking it all in. Though he was Wu-Tang, he wanted to rep Shaolin today, for his Shifu. He wore the saffron Shaolin robes with a black sash and carried a monk's bag over his shoulder. He wasn't the blunt, smoking, nut-grabbing, bottle-popping MC of the West. He was a humble disciple, full of wonder and reverence. After the demonstration, the abbot welcomed Yan Ming, Riza, and me into his chamber where he served us tea. The abbot listened attentively to Riza's questions via the interpreter and answered that many of the stories that he had heard were, in fact, myths. The abbot of Wu-Tang then presented Riza, the abbot of Wu-Tang Clan, with the gift of CDs of instrumental Taoist music. It was a surreal and sublime moment. The next day, we rode gondolas to the top of the mountain. Riza and Yan Ming sat on a wall that looked as though it was on the edge of heaven. In my bones, I felt that this trip had been predestined and that we had all met before, perhaps right here, which is why we were meant to return. This was a spectacular culmination of an odyssey that had started when I had heard the first notes of Protect Your Neck. I had brought the Shaolin and the Wu-Tang together to Shaolin and Wu-Tang. Truthfully, the deepest discovery I made on this trip was a realization about myself. It took me a long time to arrive at this epiphany because I was so hardwired to be in the service of brilliant men. I had been so focused on the task of ensuring their prosperity and fostering their internal growth. This trip was the culmination of a journey of self-discovery during which I truly embraced the formidable beauty and power of my Asian heritage. And like so many things in my life, all roads had led me to Wu-Tang. And though I had brought Riza to China, it was in fact he who had delivered me there.
Chapter 6. Everything you need to know is never enough. On the way home from China, Yan Ming and I stopped through Vancouver and told my parents that we were expecting. They were out of their minds with happiness. Their daughter, who had skipped graduation at 22 to run to New York for nothing in particular, had shacked up with a good Chinese man, and they were going to be grandparents. In retrospect, I appreciate that my parents had never pressured me to get married or have children, though I'm sure they talked about it between them. They probably knew that saying something to me wouldn't have had any effect whatsoever. Motherhood, as I would soon find out, could be summed up in its entirety with these three little words. It's fucking hard. On Christmas 1999, exactly 3 months before my due date of March 25th, 2000, Yan Ming and I made our way through knee-deep snow into Alphabet City to visit John and Justine Leguizamo, whom Rosie Perez, a devoted student, had brought to train at the temple. At the time, their neighborhood seemed so far away and remote. Funnily enough, I would end up moving just a block away several years later. When we entered, John approached me, Justine now 6 months pregnant, and handed me a paperback entitled Healthy Sleep Habits, Happy Child. He said,
"Sophia, this book will change your life."
Because I would be almost 35 when I gave birth, my OBGYN recommended an amniocentesis,
a procedure that involved inserting a needle into the uterus to draw out amniotic fluid from which to screen for genetic abnormalities. At the top of 2000, Yanming and I went to the hospital to meet with a genetic counselor before the amnio. She told us about the genetic risks based on the profiles of the parents. The line on the graph for the likelihood of complications like Down syndrome was pretty flat until the mother's age hit 35, at which point the increase was dramatic. I had the amnio at 20 weeks. The procedure sounded worse than it was, but it was still pretty awful, and there were a number of things that could go wrong, like infection, miscarriage, or leaking fluid. That night, I noticed a drop of blood in my urine and called Dr. Allen immediately. She put me on bed rest at that moment. I could get up and go to the bathroom and wander around the apartment, but being too active was out of the question. This was a really difficult state for someone used to training in Kung Fu every day and being out and about. I went stir-fucking-crazy. I had a dry erase calendar and would cross off the days until I could get out of bed. During this time, a nurse from the hospital where I was to give birth came to show Yanming and me a video about childbirth that covered topics like Lamaze classes, cesareans, and epidurals. I asked how many first-time mothers got epidurals and was alarmed to hear the rate was about 90% at that hospital. It seemed inevitable that I would have an epidural as well, despite wanting to give birth naturally. Dr. Allen called first thing the next morning and summoned us to her office. The nurse, God bless her, had called Dr. Allen after the visit and said, "Dr. Allen, I don't think we can give Sophia and Yanming the experience they want in childbirth." Dr. Allen said, "When you give birth with me, it will be in a brightly lit and steely room. I see childbirth as a medical procedure." Then she turned her steady gaze to Yanming. "You see it as a natural one. So I've decided that you're going to see my friend Dr. Barbara Brennan, who runs a midwifery service. You're at 36 weeks and she's not supposed to take anyone past 28, but she's an old friend and is doing me a personal favor. I will also refund you all the money you've paid me." We hear nightmares about the medical system, but I was the beneficiary of two incredible women, the nurse and Dr. Allen, who put my interest first. And then the midwives. I went to see Dr. Brennan immediately. There were five midwives in the practice. Seeing as it was my last month, I would see a different one each week. They were all wonderful and made me feel so comfortable and safe. Still, I was nervous and scared because both my brother and I were C-section babies. And then there's the pain. When I asked Joan what it felt like, she said,
"It's like taking the biggest shit of your life. And it's all about your relationship with pain."
Thankfully, having trained so intensely with Yanming, Pain and I had become fast friends. On March 16, 2000, shortly after Yanming had wrapped taping the Dr. Joy Brown show at CBS Studios, my water broke, 9 days before my due date. I called my midwives. They said I had time to go home and pick up my bag. The midwife on call was the only one I hadn't met, but they were all so lovely that I was confident she'd be great. Yanming's student and friend of the family, Joe Portella, drove us home. We got our things, rushed back to the hospital, and checked into the birthing center around 5:30 p.m. The room looked like a very clean Holiday Inn. There was a queen-size bed with a colorful floral quilt, a rocking chair, and a jacuzzi. Yes, a fucking jacuzzi. It was the perfect atmosphere for me. I wasn't high risk and wanted as little medical intervention as possible. However, should anything go wrong, I was just one floor away from labor and delivery. We settled in and waited for the midwife to arrive. Her name was Anna Poroskova, and she was beautiful. 50-ish, blonde, slight wrinkles around her eyes. The second I laid eyes on her, I felt a huge sense of relief. As much relief as I could feel while my entire midsection was contorting like a beach during a tsunami. The contractions felt like unbelievably intense tightening and cramping, and I could barely breathe. I was mesmerized by Anna's beautiful lips as I focused on her breathing and followed her lead. In, out, in, out. When it finally came time to push, they asked if I wanted a mirror to see what was going on. What? Hell fucking no. I understood that it was a miracle and the circle of life, but I had no desire to see my vagina torn apart while I bled and shit uncontrollably. Yes, ladies, and yes, gentlemen, prepare yourself. You shit. It's actually probably not an issue for the mothers because, whatever, you don't care, you just want the baby out. But I've heard men say that they had no idea what was coming, and when they saw their wives, like, shitting like that, it just totally freaked them out. Guess what, you guys? I don't know, compared to fucking carrying around a baby for 9 months, I don't know, watching me shit, it's a small price to pay. My labor was mercifully short, only 3.5 hours. And because I'd been under the care of the midwives, there was no pressure to get an epidural, an episiotomy, or take oxytocin. I did it naturally. Despite the pain, I didn't scream, "I hate you!" at Yan Ming like we see in the stupid movies. I barely broke a sweat. While I was pushing, I looked up at Yan Ming over my right shoulder, and he was sweating beads the size of quarters. It was as if he was absorbing the stress and pain and helping me push. Now that's kung fu. I didn't hate him at all. I loved him even more in that moment. When our son came out, the umbilical cord was wrapped around his neck and he was blue. Yan Ming panicked. I wasn't scared because I looked at Anna and the nurse and they were completely calm. Our baby was in the hands of seasoned professionals. They took him to a table and were working to get him to breathe. Yan Ming was yelling, "Come on, Erzi," which means son in Mandarin. He didn't stop until we heard that first wail. We named our firstborn Jinlong, which means golden dragon in Mandarin. In the Chinese zodiac, the dragon is the most powerful animal, and gold, the most powerful element. 2000 was not only the year of both, but also a millennium. I can't describe the feeling when Anna laid my golden dragon gently on my chest. Looking down at this tiny life that I had carried inside me was almost otherworldly. He was so small and gentle and vulnerable. There were two things that I understood the moment that I gave birth. First, that I would die for my son. Second, that I would kill for him without hesitation nor compunction. If someone threatened him, I would summon all my strength and power and use whatever was in my reach to hurt that motherfucker. I would hulk up and grab a bagel and asphyxiate someone if necessary. Before Jinlong was even born, Yan Ming and I had discussed asking Erzi to be his godfather. We had spent a lot of time with his wife and children and were certain that they would take good care of him should anything befall us. When we asked him, he answered immediately and humbly,
"Wow, well, I've never been asked that before. Yeah, of course, man. I'd be honored to be the godfather to the golden dragon."
When Jinlong was an infant, I would stare in disbelief at him sleeping in the bassinet. Is that really my child? And you know what? This sense of amazement never dissipates. Even as they get older, doing whatever mundane thing, I can be struck by this very sense of awe. Just looking at my kids doing nothing in particular, I can start crying because the love is that profound. Having children was a natural extension and manifestation of the love between Yan Ming and me. Witnessing this fierce warrior, who had been training and hardening his body his entire life, metamorphose into a gentle and doting father was beautiful, but his soft approach to the children left me in the unenviable position of being the disciplinarian. Shout out to all the mothers who are the bad cops, which means pretty much all of them. I used to wonder what kind of father Yan Ming would be, having been raised in such a harsh disciplinary environment. I think after enduring a childhood that included training 12 hours a day, getting the shit kicked out of him, and doing handstands until his eyes bled, Yan Ming chose to take the opposite route. When we fell in love and decided to have children, we never discussed the practical issues. Nursing versus bottle, private versus public, family bed versus crib. And why would we? Any concerns had always managed to get worked out. But once Jinlong was born, the stakes were exponentially higher and everything changed. And when I say everything, I mean everything, especially for me. I read the book that John Leguizamo had told me would change my life, and it did, in more ways than one. The author supports the idea of letting your child cry herself to sleep, also referred to as the Ferber method, after the doctor who founded it. The notion was untenable to Yan Ming. He could not stand the sound of Jin Lun crying. It was as if someone was stabbing him in the eyes with hot needles. Me? Didn't bother me so much. I knew that crying is the only way babies know how to communicate. And as a mother, you intuitively sense when your child is crying from discomfort, for instance, I'm hungry, tired, wet, as opposed to being in pain. The first big fight Yan Ming and I ever had was over the sleep patterns for Jin Long. Because Yan Ming taught at night, I was able to start training Jin Long to fall asleep by himself, but Yan Ming would be home on the weekends, so the program was interrupted and I was never able to complete it. I nursed Jin Long to sleep every night, often falling asleep with him in the crib. I would wake up, neck sore, completely discombobulated. When I called my parents to complain, my father said, "Sophia, just do what Yan Ming wants. It's not worth the fight. It will only be a couple years." A couple of years at the time seemed like an eternity away. Looking back, it wasn't so bad, and I'm grateful that I got to spend as much time as I did with Jin Long. I nursed him for 15 months. Never mind the health benefits of a baby having mother's milk, it really is a beautiful bonding experience. That said, being pregnant for 9 months, then nursing for another 15, I was ready for a break. Thing is, I didn't grant myself one. I had a temple to build. In the spring of 2001, when Jin Long was only a year old, I started to plan our second tour of China, which would follow in late August. The two-week journey included visits to the Forbidden City, the Shaolin Temple, and the Terracotta Warriors. On September 9th, a temperate day in Beijing, our trip was drawing to a close, and I wrangled our 40 disciples into the airport. The trip had been amazing, but we were tired, hungry, and ready to go home. Yan Ming and I were anxious to get back to Jin Long, who had never been separated from us for so long and was being cared for by my parents. I made sure everyone had their passports with their visas and sent them to the line for foreigners, aka non-Chinese citizens. Yan Ming was in a separate line because he didn't have a passport. The government had confiscated it when he defected, and he was not yet a U.S. citizen. He was, in essence, a stateless individual. Like any good tour manager, I made sure the entourage was on the plane and waited for Yan Ming to clear customs before going through myself. Derek Waller, Yan Ming's faithful friend, a New York City cop, also stayed behind. We knew that it would take a minute because of his status. Suddenly, I heard Yan Ming yell from across the room, "Sophia, they're not going to let me go." I turned toward his voice. Two police officers were holding my husband's arms tightly behind his back. "You really don't know what you're going to do in a situation like that until you're actually in it." Well, I did the only thing I could think of. Stand by my man. I rushed over, grabbed Yan Ming around the chest, and held on for dear life. Derek was sitting on the floor, both of his arms locked around Yan Ming's right leg, saying, "If you take him, you're going to have to take me too." The Chinese police pulled me off Yan Ming and yelled in my face in Mandarin, "We know who you are. You're Sophia Chang. You're Canadian. This has nothing to do with you." Then, and I have no recollection of this, Yan Ming and Derek told me that the police kicked me and punched me in the face. Before I knew it, Yan Ming, Derek, and the police disappeared behind an ominous steel door. Emmerich, one of our most senior disciples, had run back from the gate wondering what the delay was. "Get everyone off the plane," I yelled. "They've taken Shifu and Dee." I watched him sprint down the long hallway back to the departing gate. Just as the plane was about to take off, he yelled for everyone to deplane. Imagine 40 Americans dashing off an aircraft with all of their luggage. If it hadn't been for their rigorous training, the discipline, and ability to follow orders, there's no way they would have been able to mobilize that quickly. They were bewildered and shaken. I ordered them to sit down and calmly told them what had transpired. As the tour leader, I knew that I had to maintain my cool, that I would set the tone, and though I was panicking inside, I could not betray that emotion. I feared for Yan Ming's life. This was China. I was afraid they could throw Yan Ming in prison, or worse, without any recourse, and we might never see him again. Even with that, my overwhelming instinct was to get back to our 18-month-old son. I called the U.S. Embassy and arranged for someone to come and get Yeming and Derek out. I assured everyone that everything was going to be okay, though I had no way of knowing that. Despite my level demeanor, a number of the 40 students were terrified and weeping. Yeming and Derek finally emerged. Derek was silent. He looked like he was in shock. A single tear trickled out of one eye. He told me the cops had beaten both of them, but that's not what had scared him. As they were trying to explain who they were, Derek had taken his badge and passport out to show them that he was a U.S. citizen and an officer of the law. They grabbed both and threw them with utter disregard into a garbage can. In this single gesture, they had expunged his existence. I looked at Yeming and said with little emotion, "I have to get home to Jinlong." He agreed wholeheartedly. I had already worked out who would stay with Yeming and how everyone else would get home. A small group of his most senior and loyal disciples would stay behind at a hotel in Beijing to continue to communicate with the embassy and ensure his safe passage back to the U.S. I walked away from the crowd of students and changed my ticket. I stopped through Narita, Japan, where I played Crash Bandicoot like an automaton on a public PlayStation. On the flight home, I wondered how the police knew who I was, how they knew we were going to be at the airport, and at that exact time. Clearly, we had been flagged, and they were waiting for us. It had to be an inside job. But who? I had no answers. I ate a little, slept fitfully, but still, no tears. When I landed at JFK, I stood in an interminable line at customs and thankfully got through with ease. I walked out to the curb and got into a yellow cab. As my taxi drove over the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, I looked across the East River at the iconic Manhattan skyline. On that day, the comfort was mixed with unease. I called the RZA as we neared the city, traversing the Williamsburg Bridge, and watched Brooklyn receding into the distance, the projects lining the FDR before me, the East River below. I'm home. I'll be holding Jinlong soon. I'm okay. But the second I heard RZA answer,
"Peace off,"
I started to cry uncontrollably. I could barely breathe.
"Yo, self as well."
After sobbing for a solid minute, I managed to get the story out. When I'd finished, RZA asked calmly,
"Yo, is he safe? I mean, physically safe. I mean, are they gonna hurt him?"
"No," I answered, as by that point I knew the U.S. Embassy had gotten involved. "But I don't know when he'll be back."
"Listen, it's gonna work itself out. Everything works itself out."
Those simple words made me feel so much better, and I heaved a sigh of relief. RZA had defended himself successfully against a murder charge and dodged bullets. If he told me it was going to be okay, I believed him. Waiting to exhale indeed. As I pulled up to our building, my parents were out front, sitting on the concrete stairs with Jinlong in their arms. I barely recognized the boy before me. Even in those 2 weeks, he'd grown so much. I rushed out of the cab, and his round little face lit up as he saw Mommy. I grabbed him, and I couldn't hold him tightly enough. I wanted to squeeze him so hard that somehow the pressure of our combined love would make his father suddenly appear. 2 days later, I was watching New York One, as I do every morning, and there was a story of a plane flying into one of the Twin Towers. I called Hesok, who was at home in Poughkeepsie.
"Sophia, that's not an accident. There's no way someone flies into a building by accident."
While we were on the phone, the second plane hit. I hung up and rushed up to the rooftop of our 36-story building. We lived less than 3 miles north of the World Trade Center, and it was a clear day so we could see everything. I had Jinlong on my hip and watched in disbelief as the towers fell. I ran back downstairs and watched as the news reported that 4 planes had been hijacked, 2 United and 2 American Airlines flights. My parents had just boarded an 8:30 a.m. flight out of JFK back to Vancouver. I called American Airlines and asked them if my parents' plane had been hijacked. They couldn't tell me that it hadn't. Finally, my mother called from JFK. They had been turned around and brought back to the gate. Luckily, our student Joe, the one who had taken us to the hospital for Jinlong's birth, lived on Long Island and was able to pick them up and take them to his house. They wouldn't have been able to come back to the city because all the bridges and tunnels into Manhattan were closed. I called Yan Ming right away, who at this point was at a hotel with our students. They had seen the towers fall on TV. The next day, I walked 6 blocks down Broadway to the temple to check in with Jason and Etienne, the disciples who had taken care of it in our absence. The streets were filled with people, but the energy was off. It was as if the city was at once traumatized and fortified. My own energy was off kilter, too. There was a shock of watching the towers go down, on top of not knowing if I'd ever see Yan Ming again. As I stepped into the temple, I was comforted by the familiar surroundings of the room and my routine. So I sat at the desk and attended to business, checking attendance, payment of dues, and new enrollments. Meanwhile, Jason and Etienne carefully dusted each tiny item on the altar and changed out the roses and lilies and apples and oranges. Jason, Etienne, and I talked about the horror of the fallen towers. I told them briefly about the trip and what was going on with Yan Ming. When we were done, I stood before the altar, took a deep breath, and prostrated myself before Buddha. On my knees, palms humbly outstretched, I rested my head on the carpeted floor for a beat longer than usual. "Please, bring him back safely," I prayed. When we got onto the tiny elevator, I suddenly noticed Jason's body odor, which had never struck me in the thousands of times that we'd trained together. Holy shit, I'm pregnant. Chapter 7, I Want Me Back. On the way home from the temple, I bought a pregnancy test, but I already knew. Sure enough, 2 pink lines. I saw Dr. Allen the next day to confirm that I was pregnant. She said, "Sophia, you are very lucky. Many women have trouble conceiving, and you got pregnant the first time you had your period after childbirth." I had never considered myself fortunate for being able to conceive, but knowing what I do now, I am extremely grateful. That was the first time anyone had ever talked to me about fertility, other than getting the shit scared out of me about getting pregnant in high school. I now understand that our fertility peaks in our early 20s and declines steadily thereafter, with a precipitous heightened risk of birth abnormalities at 35. I would give birth to my second child at 37. I also wish I'd thought about my parents' advanced age and how long they would have to enjoy their grandchildren. My folks got back to our place from Long Island the next day, but I wouldn't tell them about the pregnancy until the end of the first trimester, when it's considered safe to do so, especially under my uniquely stressful circumstances. I even waited a couple of days to tell Yan Ming. Things were still too tense in Beijing. When I did, he was predictably thrilled and more determined than ever to settle everything and get back to our little growing family. He too had a revelation for me. He and his brother had figured out that it was his wife who had arranged the airport ambush. Fuck. After 9 days, which felt more like 90, of the U.S. Embassy facilitating negotiations with the local Chinese government, and Yan Ming's loyal younger brother making the 9-hour drive from Dongfeng to Beijing several times, Yan Ming was finally able to come home. I told Yan Ming that if this baby made it through being beaten by the Chinese police, the worry that I might never see him again, and the largest terrorist attack on American soil, we would have to give it a name that signified that he or she was a warrior. I reminded him that on our first trip to China, De Young, his kung fu brother, had arranged for a master calligrapher to make a beautiful piece for both him and Riza. Riza wanted his to say something like,
"If you could survive the fire, you'll emerge stronger."
I said to Yan Ming, "If this baby survives, she will be a warrior, and I want the name to reflect that she's been through the fire." He came up with Jian Hong, which means straight sword that cuts through fire. I didn't know the gender, but I hoped for a girl, a big brother and a little sister, just like he saw in me. On the last day of my first trimester, I called my parents, and they were ecstatic. My wish was granted. We were going to have a baby girl. I was put on bed rest again in my second trimester because I had premature contractions. We told Jinlong that he was going to have a little sister. He was only 2, but seemed to have some grasp of what that meant. On May 2nd, 8 days before our daughter was due to make her entrance onto the world stage, I started having contractions late in the evening. I called the midwife and she sounded unconvinced that I was in labor. I feared being one of those women who gives birth in the back of a cab because the second birth is often faster than the first, so I went back to the birthing center just to be sure. The midwife on call examined me and told me I was contracting, but barely dilated. I walked around a little, was examined again, and sent home. At 5:30 the next morning, however, the contractions woke me up. They were so intense that I had to lean against the wall to take a shower. When I called the midwife and could barely get the words out between breaths, she said, "Sophia, now you're in labor." We rushed back to the hospital and I was immediately put into a bed. While I was waiting to be examined, there was an emergency that required the midwife to take her patient up to labor and delivery. She was gone a long time and I started getting nervous. When she finally came back, it was Anna, who had attended Jinlong's birth. She examined me and told me that my cervix was already 6 centimeters dilated, only 4 away from pushing. For some weird reason, the moment she said that, my legs started wobbling involuntarily. We moved into the birthing room and I had a very easy labor again. Jen Hong's umbilical cord was wrapped around her wrist, a minor complication. What was much worse was that the midwife and nurse weren't sure that the whole placenta had come out. How could they even tell? They dug up inside me for several minutes. It felt awful, but again, nothing could mitigate the joy. The very moment Jen Hong was born, I knew she would be different from her brother. Her energy was more intense, and I had no doubt that this sword would cut through many fires. Just as it was beautiful to see Yanming as a father, it was overwhelmingly touching to see Jinlong as a big brother. My parents brought this gorgeous 2-year-old soul to the hospital, and he laid a little red IKEA teddy bear next to his baby sister. From the day she was born, he has loved her so unconditionally and protected her so ardently. It's breathtaking to witness, and yet another blessing of motherhood. And thank God for the gifts, because the sacrifices are great. Anyone who says being a mother is easy is either full of shit or not doing it right. How can it not be hard? You are creating a human being. You are responsible for their physical, spiritual, mental, psychological, emotional development and well-being. You have to impart the right values and instill a sense of confidence, all while juggling the logistics of budgeting, education, health insurance, play dates, and so much more. It's overwhelming. Having 2 children naturally was more exhausting in every way. Even when they were infants, barely weighing as much as large roasting chickens, lifting, carrying, changing, feeding, and bathing them added up. None of these single activities was particularly taxing, but the aggregate of them, in addition to sleep deprivation, was wholly depleting. I also chose to nurse both my children for over a year. By the time I was done breastfeeding Jen Hong, I had either been pregnant or nursing for 4 straight years. All I could think at that point was, I want my body back. I was desperate to move more freely without having someone sucking on my breast, sleeping on my lap, or clinging to my leg. Shout out to all the mothers that are fucking jungle gyms for their little toddlers and infants. When I became pregnant the first time, a friend of the family who had 4 children herself said to me, "When the baby comes, Soph, you need to take an hour a day all to yourself. I don't care if it's reading a magazine, taking a nap, or going for a walk. Believe me, you'll need it." And how right she was. I remember thinking that Kmart, which was only a block away, was Shangri fucking Law. I practically tripped the light fantastic down the aisles. I needed independence. Even just a soupçon would do. Managing the temple was a beautiful and rewarding experience. It challenged my marketing, business, and management skills, and I grew so much as a leader in those days. But overseeing the temple, Yanming's career, the household, and the children began to feel insular and suffocating. I wanted to break out and try my hand at other creative endeavors. Before Jinlong was born, I had started developing an idea for a movie called Wu-Tang and Shaolin, based on the unique bond between Yan Ming and the RZA. It was a tale of reincarnation and unlikely friendships. I loved bridging cultures, and this was the perfect vehicle for that fascination. I was thrilled by the idea of reimagining the story that was unfolding in front of me between two of the most important men in my life.